Today is Wednesday, December 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The first doses of the coronavirus vaccine was administered Tuesday.
Her home, the UK, is now the first country in the Western world to start mass vaccinations for the public.
Plus, combating disinformation during a pandemic.
And in this viral age, where the spread of fake news is perhaps the only thing keeping pace with COVID, there has been innovation and creativity.
And we say goodbye to the man with the right stuff. We'll have these stories and more next. Margaret Keenan, a 90-year-old grandmother from Northern Ireland, became the first person in the world on Tuesday to receive the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine in Britain. Reuters' Brian Wood is up first.
A British grandmother has become the first person to receive Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine outside of clinical trials. And with it, her home, the UK, is now the first country in the Western world to start mass vaccinations for the public. Margaret Keenan, a 90-year-old grandmother, received it early Tuesday morning at a hospital in central England, just a week before her 91st birthday. Known by her friends as Maggie, she's a retired jewelry shop assistant, a mother of two, and a grandmother of four. Britain has been the hardest hit by the pandemic in Europe, with over 61,000 dead, and its government is dubbing the vaccine rollout as V-Day. Priority is being given to people over 80, care home workers, and health workers. Although ultra-cold storage and logistics will limit this vaccine's mass use, Keenan's story may fuel hope in the fight against a pandemic that has crushed economies and killed more than 1.5 million people worldwide. She's told media, "I feel so privileged to be the first person vaccinated, and it's the best early birthday present I could wish for."
Researchers at Britain's Oxford University and pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca published a study on Tuesday showing that their COVID-19 vaccine candidate to be safe and effective at fighting the virus. The peer-reviewed study was published Tuesday in the British medical journal The Lancet. The data show that the drug had an overall efficacy rate of 70.4%, higher than the 50% minimum set by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine currently being administered in Britain and the Moderna candidate under review for emergency authorization in the United States and Europe have efficacy rates at over 90%. But the Oxford-AstraZeneca drug would be cheaper and easier to distribute than those other candidates. A report by the European Broadcasting Union finds the COVID-19 pandemic has accelerated change in public service media that fundamentally affects the quality of journalism in both positive and negative ways. The EBU report, Fast Forward Public Service Journalism in the Viral Age, is being launched on the eve of a two-day World Press Freedom Conference co-sponsored by UNESCO and the Netherlands. Lisa Schlein takes things from here.
A complex picture emerges from interviews with 20 news leaders across Europe regarding the lasting impacts of the coronavirus crisis on public broadcast journalism. Head of news at EBU, Liz Corbin, says the pandemic hit the fast forward button on changes, which already were in progress. She says ideas were catapulted into reality faster than could have been imagined in pre-COVID times.
And the global pandemic made people desperate for good quality information. Audiences turned in huge numbers to public service journalism providers. And in this viral age, where the spread of fake news is perhaps the only thing keeping pace with COVID, there has been innovation and creativity.
At the beginning of the pandemic, the report finds people's trust in public service media and in government was high. During this period, it says the government was supportive of the role the media were playing in distributing vital information. But when newsrooms became more critical of government's response to COVID-19, the relationship between the two institutions began to sour. Co-author of the report, Mikey Olich, says attacks by some governments and politicians against the credibility of the media have led to an erosion in public trust of newsmakers. She says threats to media freedoms and attacks targeting public service journalism have increased.
There are conspiracy theories quite abundantly, and there are accusations towards sometimes public service media or different kinds of media. And as these insecurities and the pandemic last longer, people become even more suspicious and fearful. They doubt all official voices and also public service news in that.
Navigating in these unclear waters is not easy. However, the report has several recommendations. It says public service media should always provide trustworthy, reliable information, and online journalism should tailor its reporting to audience needs. It says addressing fake news and being more attentive to undercurrents in society is key in polarized times. It stresses the importance of critical journalism, even when sharing official messages. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Talk of a chaotic British split from the European Union grew on Tuesday with just 3 weeks left to break a deadlock in trade deal negotiations, with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson warning that the two sides may have to accept no deal.
Of course, we're always... hopeful, but you know, there may come a moment when we have to acknowledge that it's time to draw stumps, and that's just the way it is.
Across the channel,
il y a aucune raison que parce que c'est important pour les Britanniques.
French Junior Minister Clément Beaune said that a deal on fisheries still wasn't close, and while France was willing to compromise, they weren't willing to give in. So where do things go from here? Well, that's a question I put to Catherine Field in Paris. And she let me know via WhatsApp.
Both sides are downplaying expectations that there could be a deal before the United Kingdom leaves the transition period. So essentially, the chief negotiator for the European Union, he told a meeting in Brussels that he really doesn't see any possibility of any sort of deal coming out in the next few weeks. He really said that there just doesn't seem to be a way out. On the UK side, they also said that. The UK Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, says it does not look good. There are bits of the puzzle everywhere, but none of it looks as though it's going to come together, and specifically not in those three areas of fisheries, governance, and competition. So it really has been a day of downbeat, of gloom, of wondering if there's ever going to be an agreement. And at the end of it all, we had one of the members of the delegation from the Netherlands saying, well, there's still a long time before the end of the year. We can keep talking till the end of the year. At which Michel Barnier, the chief negotiator, said, well, we will actually be better off, and warning the UK on this, he said, we will actually be better off if we take a breather, we spend some time next year and get the deal that we want then, rather than a bad deal now.
Well, speaking of that, it's not just, as we have mentioned before, getting a deal now. It's getting a deal, getting it translated, and getting approved by the entire bloc. But it sounds like perhaps that if they can't come to a deal before the end of the year, there may be plans to try and have an arrangement to continue the talks next year.
They would want to continue the talks next year. I mean, the feeling is that, you know, however bad a deal is, you know, they will need a deal in the end. But they'd rather have a deal that's going to be good for the next 10, 20 years rather than a bad deal that people are going to unpick in a couple of weeks' time. So, yeah, we could go beyond January 1st. There may be some sort of agreement, some sort of paperwork that has to be shunted around, so as, for example, planes can still fly, so as European aviation will be still open to the United Kingdom, so as there won't be various other border checks coming up here and there. So, you know, life will keep going. And I think that's what they want. They want to take this December 31st deadline away and get on with other issues that are coming up. Because, you know, whilst we're concentrating on Brexit, because it's the French, the UK and the Irish who are so absorbed by this, the rest of Europe is really very worried about COVID. Numbers are getting out of control, and they're very worried about the economic effects of COVID.
Catherine Field reports from Paris, France. The U.S. Supreme Court has rejected a last-ditch effort by Republicans to reverse Joe Biden's victory in the state of Pennsylvania. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has that development.
Without comment, the nation's highest court refused to negate the vote certification process in Pennsylvania. Republican Congressman Mike Kelly and others asked the justices to intervene after the state Supreme Court turned away their case. The Republicans argue Pennsylvania's vote by mail law is unconstitutional because it wasn't passed as a constitutional amendment. The governor's already certified Biden's win in Pennsylvania. The state's 20 electors are set to meet December 14th. To cast their votes for Biden. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Hong Kong police arrested 8 more activists on Tuesday over anti-government protests in July. Reporter Ria Mogul is in the special administrative region.
Right. So Ted Hoi, the one who's been making headlines the most, he is a former Democratic Party lawmaker, and all of the others are part of the opposition camp as well, who were heavily involved in last year's anti-government protests in Hong Kong. Now, Ted Hoi and the others, they resigned along with the rest of their camp last month after Beijing voted out their colleagues out of LegCo. He was out on bail and awaiting trial on charges related to last year's anti-government protests. Ted, in particular, he left the city for Denmark last week with the court's permission to attend climate change meetings, only to announce later that he had decided to enter a self-imposed exile in the UK. And then shortly after his arrival there, he said that his bank accounts and those of his family members who bank with various banks in Hong Kong, including HSBC, Bank of China, and Hang Seng Bank, had been frozen. So there's several other lawmakers. Eddie Chu is one of them. Eddie was also part of the opposition. He posted on Twitter last night saying that he is out on bail and he has to appear in court again next in a few weeks' time.
Carrie Lam, the city's chief executive, came out and criticized Ted Hoi for making comments about the banking system. Can you explain a little bit about what the rationale the authorities have given for freezing the assets?
Yeah, so the police have said that the reason they've frozen Ted Hoi's bank accounts was to do with a money laundering sort of attempt that Ted Hoi was involved with. Now, in a press conference yesterday in Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, our chief executive, attacked Ted Hoi, stating that if any damage had been done to the financial sector, he was the one who did it. She said during this press conference, and I quote, that Hong Kong's monetary and financial systems are robust as ever. And she urged the public to question sort of the character of Ted Hoi. And what we know so far is that the police are continuing to investigate.
That was Ria Mogul speaking to me from Hong Kong via WhatsApp. A top U.S. counterterrorism official has expressed concern about the deteriorating situation in Mozambique, where an Islamic State-affiliated group has captured territory in the country's northeast. But Ambassador-at-Large Nathan Sales says a military solution is not the answer. VOA's Anita Powell is up next.
For 3 years, northern Mozambique has been a hotbed of activity by a shadowy Islamist militant group. Their attacks have led to the displacement of more than 400,000 people and the deaths of more than 2,000 in the Cabo Delgado region. But as a top U.S. counterterrorism official says, this conflict affects much more than a rural corner of one southern African nation. The conflict has recently spread to neighboring Tanzania, raising the potential of dragging the region into instability and boosting a group with declared ties to the Islamic State. Ambassador-at-Large Nathan Sales, the U.S. coordinator for counterterrorism, recently visited Mozambique and South Africa to see how the U.S. can help, as he said, contain, degrade, and defeat the growing movement. With the situation this complicated, he said, a military solution is not enough. He spoke to reporters Tuesday via teleconference from Washington.
In addition to the security challenges posed by ISIS actors there, we also have the knock-on consequences from a humanitarian standpoint, with hundreds of thousands of Mozambican citizens fleeing the violence. And so part of the response has to include meeting that humanitarian need. We have to get the security situation under control so that people feel comfortable and safe returning to their homes, returning to their lives. The United States has been very active over the years, and especially recently, in devoting resources to help address the humanitarian situation in Cabo Delgado. And we'll look to continue to do so, partnering not just with government entities, but with NGOs that have access and expertise that we need to rely on.
Alex Vines, director of the Africa program at Chatham House, said there are several reasons the world is paying attention to this small corner of Africa. For one, Cabo Delgado has vast, still untapped oil and gas deposits estimated to be worth $60 billion. Instability has prevented those from being developed. And he adds the militant group is getting bolder, helped by the failures of the Mozambican government.
So there's local grievance, there's real frustration that the Mozambican state, the party of government in particular, has not delivered. So disenfranchised, frustrated young people. And I think also that the impact of the cyclone last year in the far north there, so Cyclone Kenneth, that the poor humanitarian response also drove people into becoming more sympathetic to this insurgency. So it's a mixture of all these things, and there's not one key driver. But what's worrying is that it's also a magnet attracting radical jihadists who have been operational elsewhere, looking at Cabo Delgado as maybe a new potential theater for them. And that's particularly worrying, and hence why a U.S. official has been visiting Mozambique to discuss this issue with the Mozambican authorities.
So what are the outlines of the U.S. plan on that? Sales was vague.
What we need to do is make sure that we in the United States are making available to our Mozambican partners every capability that we have to help them degrade and ultimately defeat that terrorist threat. I think you can expect that these conversations will continue into the future as we look to match American capabilities to Mozambican needs. And of course, we want to work very closely with our partners. Once we have reached a consensus, once we have reached an agreement on what our partnership could look like, the precise contours of what that partnership could look like, I'm sure we'll be in a position to share more information about what that will look like.
The U.S. is not the only outside party trying to intervene. This week, Pope Francis donated $121,000 to support victims of militant attacks in Cabo Delgado. Those funds will be used to build health facilities for the displaced. And Vines noted mercenaries with the shadowy Wagner group arrived in Mozambique in late 2019 to help Mozambican security forces. Top U.S. military officials have echoed analysts who believe the Wagner group is closely connected to the Kremlin, a charge Russian officials have denied. Mozambique has also been in talks with Britain and neighboring South Africa for possible support in combating the growing insurgency. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And still to come.
Now, for a species that was already heavily impacted, this is a really disturbing number and one that we're deeply concerned about. These numbers are really off the charts, and they drive home the unprecedented nature of the Australian bushfires that really require a massive response.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
It's thought that Earth's atmosphere is composed of mostly nitrogen, some oxygen, a little bit of argon, and carbon dioxide, as well as tiny amounts of other gases and water vapor. Scientists from Switzerland's University of Bern and the University of Geneva found vaporized metals in the atmosphere of an exoplanet called WASP-121b. After studying data collected by the HARPS spectrograph on the European Southern Observatory's La Silla telescope, the scientists detected gases containing vanadium, iron, chromium, calcium, sodium, magnesium, and nickel in WASP-121b's atmosphere. These vaporized metals are thought to be the result of the incredibly hot temperatures of the exoplanet. Earlier calculations indicated that the planet's upper atmosphere temperature can reach over 2,500 degrees Celsius. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Ethiopian government says its forces shot at United Nations staff members in the country's embattled Tigray region on Sunday after the staffers breached two checkpoints. Senior government official Redwan Hussein told reporters in Addis Ababa on Tuesday that the incident happened as UN team members tried to reach the Shem Elba camp for Eritrean refugees. A UN spokesman in Nairobi did not immediately respond to a request for comment. New Zealand's Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, has apologized for failings in the lead-up to the 2019 Christchurch terrorist attacks after a royal commission recommended a raft of legislative changes to prevent another massacre in the future. Phil Mercer reports.
In March 2019, Brenton Tarrant, a self-confessed white supremacist from Australia, opened fire at two mosques in the New Zealand city of Christchurch, killing 51 worshippers and wounding another 40. A royal commission, the nation's highest form of inquiry, has examined how the mass shootings took place and what led to them. It found New Zealand's intelligence services were almost exclusively focused on the threat from Islamist terrorism, and the police had failed to enforce proper checks on firearm licenses. It concluded that despite these failures, the attacks were unpreventable. Tarrant had moved to New Zealand in 2017 and was granted a gun license about 3 months later. The commission said the attack was driven by an extreme right-wing Islamophobic ideology. Its aim was to promote chaos and disharmony in New Zealand. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says the commission found no failures within any government agencies that would have allowed the gunman's conspiracy to be detected or stopped. Her government has accepted in principle the report's 44 recommendations. They include a new security and intelligence agency, a new counter-terrorism minister, and funding for research into extremism that is specific to New Zealand, a South Pacific country of 5 million people.
A report that's taken this length of time for an event that was as significant as March 15. It is a very comprehensive report, and it does span across a number of areas. They don't just relate, for instance, to our security and intelligence agencies. And so it will take some time for us to be able to implement some of the findings. However, some we will be able to move on quite quickly.
Families of the survivors and victims of the Christchurch mosque shootings believe the report's recommendations don't go far enough. The Islamic Women's Council of New Zealand said in a statement that justice has not been served by the report, which they say was severely restricted by the terms of reference. The Royal Commission gathered information from hundreds of interviews, including the gunmen, government ministers, and senior public servants. Many interviews, including with Prime Minister Ardern, will be suppressed for 30 years. Information from Brenton Tarrant has been permanently classified. In August this year, Tarrant was sentenced to life in prison without parole. He admitted to 51 counts of murder, 40 charges of attempted murder, and a terrorism offence. The judge said his actions were inhuman, saying he showed no mercy. His crimes led to an overhaul of gun ownership in New Zealand. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
More than 60,000 koalas were killed, injured, or displaced in Australian brush fires last summer, the World Wildlife Fund for Nature has estimated, in what it called a deeply disturbing number for a species already in trouble. Reuters' Emer McCarthy brings us that story.
With their burnt noses and singed paws, the confronting images of injured koalas have become an enduring sight of what Australia's government has called the Black Summer, the bushfires at the beginning of 2020. And now the magnitude of the crisis is forming more fully. The World Wildlife Fund is estimating that more than 60,000 koalas were killed, injured, or displaced in the blazes. For perspective, there's only about 330,000 in the country as of 4 years ago. But continual bushfires each year were thought to have already reduced that number. WWF's Australia CEO, Dermot O'Gorman.
Now, for a species that was already heavily impacted, this is a really disturbing number and one that we're deeply concerned about. These numbers are really off the charts, and they drive home the unprecedented nature of the Australian bushfires that really require a massive response.
Last summer's bushfires also killed 33 people and razed over 59 million acres across the country. Even before the fires, koala habitats had been in rapid decline due to land clearing for agriculture, urban development, mining, and forestry. But the WWF says that not all hope is lost.
We've been humbled by the reaction from the Australian public and from our supporters to Regenerate Australia. And we are determined going into 2021 to be able to make it a year in which we turn round the plight of Australian wildlife and regenerate Australia for current and future generations.
To do so, the WWF aims to double the number of koalas in eastern Australia by 2050. The plan includes a trial of drones to drop seeds of eucalyptus trees, which provide both food and shelter for koalas, and the establishment of a fund to encourage landowners to create koala safe havens.
Emer McCarthy reports for Reuters News. And finally, retired Air Force Brigadier General Charles Chuck Yeager, who showed that he had the right stuff when he became the first person to fly faster than the speed of sound, has passed away. He was 97. AP correspondent Julie Walker has this look at his life.
Yeager's wife, Victoria, announced on Twitter he died Monday. In 1947, Yeager, then 24, broke the sound barrier, flying 660 miles per hour. His exploits were told in the book and movie The Right Stuff. He fought in World War II and the Vietnam War, was awarded the Purple Heart and the Presidential Medal of Freedom. At age 79, Yeager piloted an F-15 to near 1,000 miles per hour. Looking back on his life, he once said, "I was just a lucky kid who caught the right ride." Chuck Yeager, dead at 97. I'm Julie Walker.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a wonderful Wednesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The 16 days between International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, observed on November 25th, and Human Rights Day, celebrated on December 10th, are dedicated to campaigning around the world to raise awareness of gender-based violence and mobilizing people everywhere to bring about change against gender-based violence. Violence against women transcends borders and cultures. One in three women experience gender-based violence in her lifetime. Unfortunately, these numbers have risen under the COVID-19 pandemic, said USAID Acting Deputy Administrator John Barsa. USAID's partners have seen an increase of violence against women and girls as lockdowns disrupt livelihoods and access to affordable food and goods becomes harder. USAID has for a long time recognized the importance of addressing the various forms of violence that affect women's ability to thrive and succeed. Under the Trump administration, USAID has expanded our partnerships with non-governmental organizations, women's groups, private sector firms, and government institutions to implement effective programs to increase awareness and prevention of the harmful impacts of violence against women, said Acting Deputy Administrator Barsa. For example, through U.S. Strategy on Women, Peace, and Security, programs are working to protect women and girls from violence, exploitation, and abuse in the agency's development and humanitarian assistance efforts. Since 2017, USAID has enabled the participation of some 70,000 women in peacebuilding processes and provided critical care, psychosocial support, legal aid, and economic assistance to over 6 million survivors of gender-based violence. But it is a long uphill battle. That's because gender-based violence is too often normalized within a given society, the result of community and government failure to recognize and value the human rights of women and girls. That is why calls to action like 16 days of activism against gender-based violence are so very important to the fight to eliminate gender-based violence. They shine a light on this scourge and on the policies and practices that allow it to exist. We all have a role to play in ending violence against women, mitigating its harmful effects on individuals, families, and communities, and promoting the rights of all individuals, said Acting Deputy Administrator Barsa. During these 16 days and every day, USAID stands unified in preserving and protecting the dignity of women and girls worldwide.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States.